From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, GE says it will sell its Seaport HQ property and return money to the state. Meanwhile, Amazon says it won't build a second headquarters in New York. And a year after the deadliest high school shooting in U.S. history, what are local students thinking?
I know that people, including myself, will talk day to day about, like, oh, that's the closet you go in, or oh, that's the window that we would have to jump out of.
Also today, the debate over the use of the N-word during a high school classroom discussion in Cambridge.
It is very hard to talk about race in Cambridge. And I think it's because Cambridge sees itself as so progressive, so forward, that I think Cambridge has imagined that it was post-racial.
And it's Valentine's Day, but dating, it's complicated.
The level of dating fatigue is at an all-time high. Because dating apps are available 24/7, it becomes a job.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. It's Valentine's Day, but we begin with bad news about two relationships. GE says it's not going to build a new headquarters in Boston's Fort Point neighborhood after all. The company will instead sell the property it bought here and give back some $87 million of tax incentives to the state. And Amazon is calling off its engagement to New York. Facing community opposition, the tech giant says it won't put a second headquarters in Queens. Amazon says it's moving ahead with its other HQ2 site in Virginia, but won't look for another suitor to replace Long Island City. And joining me now with more is WBUR Bostonomics reporter Zeninjor Enwemeka. Hi, Zeninjor.
Hey, Callum.
So you're following this rolling breaking news on
yes.
two fronts today. Let's start with GE. Let's start with the locals. What's going on here? Is this a total breakup or will the company still have a presence here in Boston?
Yeah, well, boy. Well, first of all, boy, I mean, this has been quite a day for some of the world's biggest companies
Indeed.
Here. But yeah, so with GE, GE will still have a presence in Boston. As you mentioned, they announced today they're scaling back their headquarters in Boston. They're going to pay the state back the massive incentive package, $87 million that it received. And, you know, as you know, GE has had many struggles over the last couple years. And so we're really seeing the results of that. Ann Klee, the vice president of Boston Development and Operations for GE, told WBUR in a statement that while changes in the company's portfolio and operating model will lead to a smaller corporate headquarters, they are fully committed to Boston and proud to call it home. So the company will still be here in Boston, but they won't be building, that 12-story tower that they were supposed to.
So that's what the company is saying. What are you hearing from local officials about today's news?
Yes. Lizzie Guyton from the governor's office told us that the administration, together with Mass Development, reached an agreement with GE for the company to fully reimburse the Commonwealth for the costs and expenses associated with the Necco Street project. And the administration looks forward to working with GE as the company grows its world headquarters here in Boston. I spoke with the mayor of Somerville, Joe Curtatone, and he said in light of both of these big stories today, GE and Amazon, that the region needs to remember the downsides of giving these massive incentives.
We need to stay true to our values, stay true to our objectives. And because a major company comes in that you didn't expect or is looking for a place to be, you know, the challenge for us is to, again, take a deep breath, understand what we're trying to accomplish and not just lead with giving away the resources that we that are so critical for our community success.
And as a reminder, you know, Somerville was one of the 20 finalists for Amazon's second headquarters. And one of the things that stood out about that bid was they didn't offer any tax incentives.
Right. I remember we had Curtatone on this show the day after or the day that Amazon made its HQ2 announcement. He was very proud that they hadn't given those kind of gifts away. But Zeninjor, you know, I can't help but think about the other promises that GE has made both to Boston and elsewhere. I mean, just last week we were reporting on France clawing back some $57 million from
yep.
GE that had promised there because they were falling short of the job growth proposals. And I just wonder if it calls into question the whole principle of offering massive tax incentives and sweetheart deals to get big companies into your city.
It certainly raises that question. I think many people would say yes. I mean, we have GE paying back these massive incentives here in Massachusetts after its struggles. We have Amazon canceling its plans in New York after a pushback around its incentives. I spoke with Jeff Busking about this. He's a lecturer, senior lecturer at Harvard Business School and the co-founder of Flybridge Capital. He said, yes, there's a big lesson here for cities on incentives.
I think the lesson for cities is to focus on creating a great environment, a great infrastructure, and a great ecosystem, and not use tax incentives to focus on one particular company or another, because those companies are going to change. There is a natural ebb and flow to the market, and cities don't want to be dependent on the ebbs and flows and the competitive positioning of any one company.
I mean, that's logical advice to endure, but I mean, in the case of New York, it's such a big city that it wouldn't have been dependent on any one company, even with 25,000 Amazon employees. So what went wrong there? That wasn't a case of all the eggs in one basket.
Right. Well, so, I mean, Amazon faced a lot of fierce opposition, and we've been hearing a lot of reports about that over the last several weeks. Opposition from local lawmakers, and things seem to really be heating up recently. The main contention is really over tax incentives. And remember, New York offered nearly $3 billion in incentives to Amazon for its big sprawling complex that it planned in Queens. And so it just fell apart from there. In a statement, Amazon said that it was clear to them that local politicians opposed their presence and they could not work together on a solution. Again, I spoke with Jeff Busgang about this, and he says, in this regard, Boston is very different than New York, that here we have a culture of collaboration between city and state officials and businesses.
I think it's one of the strengths we have in Massachusetts, is that the public sector and the private sector and the various pieces in each of those sectors are all pretty collaborative and pretty aligned. And when we pursue opportunities, we do it as a team. And that sort of teamwork is pretty critical for progress in these areas.
I've heard that from a lot of business people in Boston as well as in New York. And even when Amazon made his first decision not to come to Boston, some people said, you know, that's fine. In fact, we're better off just sort of having this organic growth locally. Is that what you're hearing from business leaders in Boston today?
Absolutely. I mean, that seems to be a point of pride that there is this collaboration, that there is this strong ecosystem here, and that, you know, some are saying, look, we're not chasing after companies like Amazon. And, you know, that's something that... I don't know how many people are fretting over this, but it's interesting to see these developments today.
Last thing I'm wondering, Zininjor, is whether Amazon just played everybody in this whole search process. I mean, you had all these cities all across the country rolling out the red carpet for a big company on the premise that they were going to get a 50,000 employee second headquarters. Nobody got 50,000 employees. And then even New York, which was going to get half of those, they were going to get 25. That's not even materializing there in New York. So what's the takeaway here? I mean, were we all just suckers in this whole process?
It's certainly interesting. It was a very unique process. And that's something I actually spoke with Jim Rooney about. He's the president of the Greater Boston Chamber of Commerce, talking about how it was quite a strange process. He was involved with the local Amazon bid. And he says, you know, there are certainly a lot of lessons here and that it's something that there needs to be more consideration in terms of that, again, that collaboration within the community.
If there's going to be a big development of any kind, many of our cities, and you know, this includes Boston, are in a situation where they have to measure how the local population and the local infrastructure systems are going to receive a large influx of a major development.
Well, apparently that's not what happened in New York, but Boston can feel good that it hasn't run into that problem in the case of Amazon here.
Certainly.
That's Bostonomics reporter Zininjor Enwemeka. Thanks again for jumping in on this breaking news day.
You're welcome.
It's the one-year anniversary of the shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. A gunman there killed 17 people, including students and staff, in the deadliest high school shooting in American history. In a time when mass shootings happen with alarming frequency and then typically fade from headlines, Parkland's staying power stands out. The March for Our Lives campaign and the hashtag Never Again movement have become political forces, led primarily by students fighting to tighten gun laws. Among the student organizers is Amalia Hockman, a junior at Somerville High School. When we talked about her activism, I started by asking her how she feels a year after the Parkland shooting.
It's definitely hitting me hard. I've been thinking a lot with my friends, and we're like, wow, like, it's been a whole year. It it hasn't felt like it's been that long. It felt like it just happened like last week.
You know, in the past year, 26 states and the District of Columbia have passed some type of gun control measure. Massachusetts was one of those states. Here we passed a red flag bill that makes it possible for legal gun owners to temporarily lose their gun rights if a family member or friend reports them as dangerous. I know that you supported that law.
Yeah.
And I'm curious whether you take that as a sign of real meaningful change in the past year, or is it just sort of a drop in the bucket? What's your assessment?
I think that any time that a group of people can organize to get real work done, like passing a bill like this ERPO bill, I think is incredible. And I think it's a huge step forward, no matter what. But I don't think that people can just stop there and like, oh, we got a bill passed or all these states passed things. Like, we got to keep going.
ERPO for Extreme Risk Protection Order.
Exactly.
Right? You know, we spoke with you twice on Radio Boston last year, once right after you helped organize a walkout at your school, and again later to hear how you were processing a school shooting in Texas over the summer. And at that time, we asked whether you were surprised that there had been another school shooting so soon after Parkland, and you said no, and that you didn't ever really feel completely safe from gun violence. So how are you feeling today? Do you feel safe when you go to school?
I think that the question of feeling safe is a really tricky one to answer. I think compared to other schools, yeah, I think my school is not in an extreme high risk. But on the other hand, they almost seem random. And I know that people, including myself, will talk day to day about like, oh, that's the closet you go in, or oh, that's the window that we would have to jump out of. And it's something that is scary that we do have to talk about. So it's not like every day I step in the building and I'm like, I could die today. But there's that little thought in the back of my head that, yeah, it's possible.
Those are just the things that come up as you're passing in the hallway.
Right.
Is it formalized in any way, or is it just sort of student-to-student conversations? Like, are you running active shooter drills at Somerville High, or is it sort of among you, just you students informally talking about what your plan would be?
We've had one lockdown drill this year, and those are quite scary. We'll have people coming in and trying to get into the classrooms and banging on doors. So definitely people will talk about it more then, but mainly informally, people will just randomly bring it up if something scares them.
What's your view of those kinds of preparations? Because I think that they're quite polarizing. You know, some folks think that this is just the world that we live in, and our students need to be prepared. We should be perhaps even teaching them first aid and CPR in these events. And then others say, you know what, we're just scaring kids. As much as these school shootings are awful, they do happen very rarely in the grand scheme of things. We're just feeding into a culture of fear. Now, how do you feel about it?
I think that because it is a reality that there are school shootings, I think that it is important that kids know what to do in case that happens. But on the other hand, I really do feel like we need to be putting more effort into trying to stop it than how much we put into trying to lessen how bad it could be if it happens.
I want to play some sound from gun control activist David Hogg. He survived the shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High. He's since graduated, and he spoke with NPR yesterday about the future.
I don't think older generations realize what an impact the shooting here has had on our generation. I don't think people realize how big the school walkouts were and how many student leaders came out of that. I don't think congressmen are realizing what they have coming.
Amalia, do you agree with David? I mean, have school shootings galvanized a whole generation of activists and voters?
I completely agree with him. I think that the whole March for Our Lives movement has completely empowered my generation to show us that we can fight for what we believe in and that we can win if we fight hard enough.
You know, I saw the look of immediate recognition when I mentioned David Hogg's name on your face. And in our first conversation with you last year, on the day of that student walkout last March, you talked about what really motivated you to get involved in this cause. And you said that you were inspired by those Parkland students. Let's just take a listen to that previous interview.
We're finally stepping out and saying this has to stop. And I'm not going to sit by while 7 kids a day in the U.S. are killed by guns. And I'm not going to sit by and let especially communities of color be targeted by gun violence. And I want to stand up and I want to stand in solidarity. And I want to make sure that this country and these schools and our streets are safer for the generations to come.
So, Amalia, we're almost a year beyond those remarks from you. Do you still feel that same sense of energy and urgency?
Yeah, I feel like the national feel of we got to fight for gun control has definitely gone down. But I think that there were incredible strides made And I definitely still feel like it's still extremely important to keep fighting for this, because there are still guns in schools. There are still guns on the streets. And we need to be fighting for this until it ends, because we can't just wait for the next shooting to happen to be like, oh, yeah, we need gun control. Like, we need it now. We need it then. We needed it before. And so we need to keep fighting until it happens.
What have you found to be an effective organizing tool for students your age? I mean, are you planning more walkouts? We've seen very dramatic die-ins in the past. Is that the kind of path that you found to be effective, or is it something else?
I think the easiest way to organize my generation, at least, is what I found in my school is through social media, is really getting it on people's minds all the time. If they keep seeing it in their feed, they're like, oh, yeah, this is an issue that's important to my friends. This is an issue that's important to my community. And so it's kind of always there, so that when there is a walkout or when there is a protest or when there is a rally, it's already on people's minds like, yeah, I need to go to that.
Is it a particular tool on social media? Because I noticed that you haven't been tweeting lately, and I wondered if maybe you found that it wasn't a productive platform for you, or are you using something else instead?
No, to be honest, I'm just not that good at Twitter. When I've been organizing the most on social media, I've actually used Snapchat.
Really?
Yeah, I've found that it hits the most people in my community. And it was the most effective, because people, like, if we were organizing a protest, people were able to just screenshot it and post it to their story, and it would just reach so many people.
Do you foresee gun control as a lifelong cause for you, Amalia? Or is it maybe just sort of a broader awakening to civic engagement because of what happened in Parkland?
I definitely think it's something that I'd love to be working on, hopefully not for the rest of my life, because I'm hoping that we'll get the kind of gun control needed before then. But if it takes for the rest of my life, I'll definitely be in it.
What would that success look like in your eyes?
To be honest, if it were up to me, I think I'd take away the Second Amendment. And I know that's really extreme for a lot of people, but I do not see a reason why people would need guns.
That's Amalia Hochman, a junior at Somerville High School and a Students Against Gun Violence co-organizer. Amalia, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And you can hear the conversations we had with Amalia last year on our website, radioboston.org. Stay with us. Coming up, we'll explore the use of racial slurs in an academic setting. I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston. An incident involving the N-word at Cambridge Ringe and Latin School has sparked a debate about what is and is not acceptable in an academic setting. Here's the backstory. Kevin Dua, a history teacher at the school, recently led a class project called Reclaiming, N-word and Cracker, Defining Racial Context in/for Cambridge. Dua, who is black, spelled out the full N-word in the title of the project and also used the full N-word in class discussions. Cambridge School Committee member Emily Dexter, who is white, also said the full N-word when she joined one of those discussions last month. Dexter's usage offended some who heard it or heard about it. Now, she returned to class the following week to apologize, but has not satisfied everyone. And now the Cambridge School Committee has launched an outside investigation. Joining us is Cambridge School Committee member Lawrence Kimbrough, who was in the classroom when Dexter said the N-word. Lawrence, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks, Colin. I felt really fortunate to be here for this important conversation.
And also with us on the line from Manchester, New Hampshire, is Darnisa Amante, founder and CEO of DEEP. That's the Disruptive Equity Education Project. Welcome to you as well.
Thank you. Excited to be here.
Lawrence, I want to start with you since you were actually in the classroom. Can you give us some context? How was the word said? What was the initial reaction like from students when they heard it?
So my colleague and I were there to really engage in a conversation with students about filters on computers. And as part of our equity work in the Cambridge Public Schools, all of our students get laptop computers to bring home with them and use for research and other work. And in the course of this project, students found that they were not able to do research through those filters on the school computers about the N-word and about the term cracker as well.
It wouldn't just be blacked out. They just couldn't even find the information they needed to do
their work. They couldn't find the information they needed for the work. And so, you know, as district leaders, we were brought in along with the superintendent and some folks from the IT department. And, you know, during the course of the conversation, you know, my colleague, when speaking about and comparing textbooks to the filters, used the N-word and said that, you know, you wouldn't be able to find the N-word in textbooks either. And so that was the context of how she quoted the N-word in our conversation.
And last week, the school committee that you're on decided to launch an outside investigation. Why did you all, and it was a unanimous vote, I should mm-hmm. say, so why did you all collectively decide that was the appropriate way to proceed, especially since you were actually in the room, so you have a sense of what happened?
Yeah, it felt, at least for me, certainly in the Cambridge Public Schools over the past several months, we've had lots of concerns around, you know, racial equity, anti-racism work that needs to happen in our schools. And, you know, for our students who I think have felt really challenged by their experiences as African-American students, Latino students, students of color in our schools, it felt like a really important gesture to them to say that, you know, we take this issue very seriously and that, you know, an investigation would feel like a really sort of important way for students to be able to come to peace and some sort of level of understanding about what took place in the classroom there for the students who were not able to be there at that time.
You know, I noticed a moment ago that you said Dexter had quoted the N-word, and during the committee meeting last week, you proposed a language change in the motion to investigate. You suggested a wording that would have said Dexter had quoted the N-word as opposed to used the N-word. Your colleagues rejected that proposal as a semantic argument, but I take it that you see a meaningful difference there between using and quoting. So can you explain that?
Yeah, so I think when you use a word, it particularly a word like the M-word, you're usually using it to demean, disrespect. It is used towards another person as, you know, someone who is just is not worthy of consideration. I think when you are quoting the N-word, it has a different meaning. You know, this is certainly a word that has power and I think needs to be discussed and talked about. And I think my colleague quoted the N-word in a conversation about the N-word. It wasn't as if she was directing it towards anybody. And so I think in many sort of academic environments of recently, we are finding challenges in having conversation. And I felt like it was really significant to just point out that this word was not used towards anyone in particular, but she was quoting the word in the context of the conversation we were having.
All right, Darnisa, I want to bring you into the conversation because your group describes its mission as, quote, changing mindsets around equity and dismantling systemic oppression and racism. So what's your take on what's playing out in Cambridge right now?
Thanks so much for the question, and thank you, Lawrence, for just giving us some more context to help understand. I think what's been really interesting for me sitting in the conversation, knowing that DEEP is doing a lot of work with the entire city as well as the Cambridge Public Schools, it's the dualism of what's happening. So I think sometimes what happens, especially when you start having conversations about race and when people say words that have historical meaning, right, it's very hard to hold multiple truths at one time. And so one of the things that's really important to me is always thinking about the grace factor, right? It's that I can have a positive intent, I can be a really good person, and you can still quote or say something that can do harm, right? And I think that it's important to be able to hold that both of those things can be happening at the same time. And so for me, one of the things that I've really been hoping will happen is our ability to really hold that both and, that students can have an intellectual discourse around whether it's possible to reclaim a word, like what can be said and how it should be said, along with the fact that we can still have inquiry and ask questions around words and not mean to do intentional harm, but there can be a negative impact. And I think it's important that even though we are positively intentioned, that you can acknowledge that people are simultaneously experiencing something negative on the other side of that. So for me, it's the ability to hold the both. And I'm often saying, instead of wondering always about what people don't know, or why someone might not know something, whether they be a person of color or someone who is white, I think the best way and the more systemic way to approach this is to wonder why we might not have known in the first place. I think when we talk about race, we often forget that racism and oppression are systems. They are structures that function. And if you can't call out the origin of some of our interpersonal interactions or dialogue, it makes it a me versus you versus an us understanding that there is a system that is resulting in a lack of everyone being uninformed around conversations that I think many people assume that we'll all be informed about in the first place.
Well, so Darnisa, so then should the first conversation maybe have just been to sort of set some boundaries? I mean, should the first discussion in the classroom been what language is appropriate and is not appropriate, and for whom is it appropriate or not appropriate? I imagine that Emily Dexter might have just and taking her cues from the teacher, from Kevin Dewitt, and said, okay, I gather that it's okay to use the word in full in this setting.
Yes, you know, and like I said, because I wasn't in the room, I can't exactly speak to Mr. Duwa's facilitative method. But I do know, as someone who is facilitating this work often, a very powerful way to start is what you just named, which are setting some, I like to call it the ethos, right? It's not a boundary. It's not a norm. An ethos is a culture. It's the way we are intending to be both in this conversation and ongoing. And I think because people are usually coming to conversations like these uninformed, some points around here are some things that might be helpful to know might be hurtful. I think particularly around the N-word, it has such a long-standing history in a variety of ways that many people are often not sure when it should be said, should it ever be said, who has the right to say it. And because there's usually a lot of confusion there, it's often helpful to say in the conversation, we are going to talk about reclaiming, and we might feel more comfortable if only people who identify as Black or of color, regardless of what that means for you, are using the term. And if you do not identify in that way, we would ask that you not use it because there still may be residual negative impact. And I think that would have been a really powerful way to call people into the conversation while simultaneously informing people that this word can still have, it can still cause hurt. And it does still cause hurt.
Lawrence, I want to ask you about something we saw in the Boston Globe today. And among the letters to the editor on this subject was one from Wendy Kaminer. She's a lawyer who specializes in free speech issues. And she said that she sympathizes with Emily Dexter. She says she made a similar mistake in a panel discussion some years ago. And she writes in her letter today in part, quote, I do not consider the school committee's investigation of Dexter a sign of progress. It represents a regressive embrace of language phobias that deter candid and potentially constructive conversations, ignoring critical differences between racism and speech about racism. How do you respond to that, Lawrence? I mean, is she onto something there or is she out of line?
Yeah, no, I think there's certainly a distinction to be made. I think in terms of the investigation, I want to sort of put this in the context of the students and very much how they felt in that space when my colleague quoted the N-word and the residual hurt that sort of took place after that. I think for us as a committee, you know, who is responsible for student achievement as a board, we really wanted to ensure that our students knew that this was something that we took very seriously. And I can also understand, you know, where this person is coming from in terms of, you know, we need to have discourse. We need to be able to have conversation. Does this investigation therefore shut off conversation that could be valuable, important? This certainly, I felt like, was an opportunity for learning for all of our students and all of our community. And I can certainly understand the perspective that that learning can therefore be stripped away if an investigation is going to be taking place.
Darnisa, in the moments we have left, could you help us just sort of pull back and put this episode in Cambridge into a broader context? Because we are going through a broader cultural moment right now nationwide. We're all watching this sort of spectacle unfolding in Virginia. We're learning more about the history of blackface, in some cases learning how little some folks seem to know about the history of blackface. I mean, how would you assess where we are as a society right now in terms of understanding racism and racial tensions that linger to this day?
I think where we are overall is that people are generally confused and feeling paralyzed about what does it mean to even do the work. I think we have been taught historically that we shouldn't even talk about race, that we should think about ourselves post-racially. And I think that was one of the largest fallacies that could have happened, because it actually disabled us to talk about difference, to sit in conversations about difference, and to understand the way in which different people are experiencing the world and the fact that we never actually were post-racial. And I can still simultaneously own that half of this country has experienced a post-racial type of world, right? And so that goes back to the both end that I was talking about earlier. I am finding just in the work that we're doing with schools and entire communities and organizations that people have a yearning to want to know and usually don't know what the right entry point is or the right question to ask that will not result in someone saying, I can't believe you didn't know that. I can't believe you could be so ignorant. How could you not know? How could you be this old and lived in this country and not understand what's happening? And I think we always have to remember systemic oppression functions in silence. It has a real function of denying us the ability to talk across lines of difference. And even the most basic foundational piece of this, which is the ability to hold multiple perspectives, I think we're all still learning how to do. I don't think we're lost, though. I don't think it's hopeless. But I do think that the building of deeper connections to humanity, reteaching people how to sit in difference of perspective, supporting people in understanding how to be empathetic, and supporting people in holding the fact that multiple truths are happening, that we can be really good people and do really bad things at the same time, is essential to us being able to collaboratively bring down structures and systems that oppress millions of people.
That's Darnisa Amante, founder and CEO of DEEP, the Disruptive Equity Education Project. Darnisa, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And also our thanks to Lawrence Kimbrough, Cambridge School Committee member. We really appreciate your presence here in studio.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Darnisa, let's catch up soon, girl.
Sounds great.
Stay with us. Coming up, finding love in the age of hashtag MeToo and dating apps. I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
We know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. Valentine's Day is a time to celebrate love and the ones you love, be they significant others or friends and family. And these days, you can look for romance in all kinds of places, a dating app or a website, social media, maybe even at work or a night out. But that doesn't mean dating has gotten any easier. In fact, in a world where millions of suitors are at your fingertips, just a right swipe away, dating has become complicated. Now, I've been married for 10 years and haven't been on a first date since 2005. Happy Valentine's Day, darling. The dating game has changed a lot since I was in it, so I've brought in some folks who know a lot more than I about the complications of modern-day dating. Radio Boston producers Paris Alston and Eve Zukoff. Hello to both of you.
Hi, Callum. Thanks so much for having us.
Hi, Callum.
We're also joined by Meredith Goldstein, who is behind the Boston Globe's Love Letters column for advice and also the podcast. Hello, Meredith.
Hello.
And listeners, we want to hear from you, too. In the age of dating apps, what's the dating scene like for you? What questions do you have about how to navigate it? Have certain apps or other ways of meeting people worked well for you? Are you frustrated by dating? Maybe you're single by choice. And if you're in a relationship, how did you meet your significant other? Well, you can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK or tweet us at Radio Boston. All right, Paris and Eve, you're both single, which is totally okay, despite what the Valentine's Day sensation would tell you. But tell us what dating has been like for you. Paris, let's begin with you.
Yeah, so it's been complicated, to say the least, Callum. And I'll start with, I broke up with my ex-boyfriend a little over a year ago. We had a really great relationship, but the breakup, it lasted forever. And it kind of happened in stages. At first was like, you know, there was a bit of a rift, and I sensed that it was coming. And then there were like this stage of breadcrumbs that he gave me for weeks where he just wasn't telling me what's going on. And, you know, I followed those breadcrumbs thinking they were going to lead back to us being together again. But eventually he like ghosted me. And that was just so frustrating.
All right. Quick glossary of terms here, Paris. Breadcrumbs and ghosting. Give us quick definitions.
For sure. So with breadcrumbs, you know, think about leaving a trail of breadcrumbs behind you, hoping
someone
will follow.
Hansel and Gretel style.
Okay. Exactly. You're not going to get the whole sandwich, but, you know, just leave some breadcrumbs out. And yeah, you know, keep giving people a little bit of what they want, but not the whole thing. And so that's exactly what it was. And with with ghosting, I mean, it's like you talk to someone and they're really attentive and communicative, and then all of a sudden they drop off the face of the earth. You text them, they don't answer. That you call them, they never call you back. And, you know, for me, it's like I could see that happening in a casual dating situation, but this was someone I was in a committed relationship with. And so it was very rude. And then he, you know, he would resurface every now and then, and he was kind of orbiting me. This is another very millennial term for you here, Callum. It was doing this thing where he would kind of like watch me. He would watch my Snapchat story and be in my like general, you know, orbit space, but he still would not talk to me, which was like, this is so tempting because you have one foot in and one foot out. I'm like, what do you want from me? And eventually we did kind of reconnect and we made amends and, you know, but I was like, why are you coming back? And he was doing this thing where he wanted to check in on me. And I'm like, why are you checking in? And I almost wanted to be friends with him and be nice about it. But then I was like, Drake said, be nice for what? So, like, why would I do that?
All right, I'm going to call this haunting when the ghost returns.
I like that.
I'm copywriting it right now.
And they always come back.
Meredith, do you hear this now? You take the advice, you get some calls for your podcast, you get the people who write in for your columns, ghosting, breadcrumbs, orbiting. Are these issues that
these
come
are
up?
All, you know, and the interesting thing is they're new words, but they're not new concepts. If you go back and read advice columns from 100 years ago, ghosting happened. It was even that much easier to ghost, right? It's like, where did he go? No, literally, where did he go?
Because there's, buggy, took
right, there's like no yeah. social media to tell you. So, you know, I think some of these feelings of, you know, detachment and breakups, they're universal, right? But we have new lingo for them. Now orbiting, I think, is very specific to now in that this idea that you can watch someone's social media stories and they can see you watching. So it's like, I see you. You see me seeing you, but we will not communicate, right? It's like watching somebody from across a restaurant and no one ever really truly making eye contact. So I think that can be very frustrating. It can make it harder to let go and to truly move on.
Definitely.
You're all making me glad that I wrapped up my dating career in the pre-social media.
Never let go.
Eve, I'm turning over to you next. What has your experience been like in the modern day dating scheme?
God, how much time do you have? okay, well, I feel like in my experience, I do not meet people in real life. Like, do I go to the grocery store? Do I linger there? Do I go to a coffee shop? I don't know. I feel like I'm not seeing people or having conversations with people that are like where the sparks are flying. But I think that my dating life is mostly happening on apps. And the longer I'm on these apps, I feel like the more there's the paradox of choice. Because at some point, you can only see so many like tall, scruffy, bearded brunettes holding a fish before you're like, okay, you're all the same.
And they are often holding a fish, which is a phenomenon that I think must be discussed, and the listeners must know that so many men are holding fish.
I've read about this. Yes. It's
like
a sort of a primal
thing,
right?
Sitting with their nephew, you assume they're their nephew, but you're like, I don't know, did you find a kid?
Yeah, there's a child photo, perhaps a photo with 10 people, so you have to figure out who is the person.
It's a
really,
a
apps are, yeah, a lot of fun games.
But I think it's also, at some point, it's like, is this hurting me? Because I feel like at what point do I become so fatigued, so desensitized to these eventually identical looking people? And is using these apps, is it becoming an ineffective way to look for and feel like I'm doing something when really I'm not? Mm. You know, and I wonder if these apps didn't exist, would I be actually going to a coffee shop and taking my headphones out and actually looking in the grocery store aisle? And would that change my prospects?
You know, when I think about love letters, and now that column's 10 years old, had you asked me the most common problem 10 years ago, it would have been snooping. It would have been couples breaking into each other's technology, which is not legal, I think. So don't do that. You know, breaking passwords and hacking. In 2019, it is dating fatigue. And I do think that is something specifically related to apps, because even back in my day, when I started dating, there was online dating, but there weren't apps, which meant that you could check your computer before bed and you're checking it once, one time. You can be on an app all day and all night. So when you're not on that app, you feel like you're not doing the work. And dating begins to feel like a job. And I think when people talk about dating fatigue these days, they're talking about the fact that they can be dating, in quotes, 24 hours a day. It's always available to you. It always feels like something you should be doing.
All right. Mm-hmm. Radio Boston producers Paris Alston and Eve Zukov, thank you so much for opening up yourselves to us today and sharing your experiences. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening, Callum.
Thank you.
And Meredith.
And listeners, now we're hoping it will be your turn to open up a little bit. Meredith is going to stick around and take some questions. And you can give us a ring at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're going to open up first with Helen Marie calling in from Shrewsbury. Happy Valentine's Day, Helen Marie. What is your question or what has your experience been?
Happy Valentine's Day. Thank you. I actually have a comment and a story to share about my own life. When I was 47 years old, 3 years ago, I was a single mom for about 13 years, never dated at all. And my 17-year-old son said to me, "Mom, I think you should go online, try to find a partner." I was very skeptical and said, "Oh, no, 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 never would I do that." Took me about 3 months to decide, okay, maybe I should, since I only really go to church and the library, maybe this is a good way. So I signed up, I put in all my information on CatholicMatch.com. It's a place where I felt safe to go and matched my own, you know, spirituality. Put all my information in, gave myself 9 months, and said, on the ninth month, if I don't find anybody, it's not meant to be. And on the very day of the ninth month when I went to cancel my subscription, I saw my husband, who is now my husband. I saw his picture pop up and we connected. And we've been happily, happily married for 3 years. And it's an amazing miracle story. And we're both elated with our marriage.
Well, so congratulations, Helen Marie. And thank you
thank
so much
you.
For the call. Meredith, I'm curious about that. That's an interesting story because Helen Marie is talking about she was a churchgoer anyway. In theory, she was meeting people who might be good matches. And yet she had to go online to CatholicMatch.com to actually make the connection. Do you hear stories like that?
Oh, I do. And I hear from many people who will say that they go out to a bar or to a club and what they see is a bunch of people on their phones doing Tinder. Right? So even in person, we are still interfacing in that way. And, you know, it certainly expands a community. You might not find someone in your specific church, but you might find someone in a different church. So, you know, I think that what I try to tell people is do both. One doesn't replace the other. If you're online dating, don't let that be it, but be open to it.
So as I mentioned at the top, you've got the Love Letters podcast.
Yes.
And the second season is all about how you meet someone.
Yes,
so why is that
hard? It's so hard. The first season was about breakups. And as we just heard, breakups could be very difficult. And then I thought, well, we need a prequel. You can't get dumped until you meet somebody, right? So we wanted to spend an entire season, you know, talking about ways in which we meet. You know, is the best place to meet in person? How do you navigate dating fatigue? What happens if you meet someone in the office? So we've really tried to hit every part of the meeting someone process and hopefully to give people hope.
All right, let's take another call. Rama is calling from Gloucester. I hope I'm pronouncing your name right. And what is your question or comment on this Valentine's Day?
Hi, yes. Happy Valentine's Day, everyone. Yeah, my comment is, I think Meredith just touched on it, and I would strongly, I don't know, agree and disagree with so many different things. The best place in my experience to meet someone is indeed in person. I've tried the dating apps, you know, there's plenty of fish, Tinder, plenty of wasted time, actually, for me. But I'm not a gadget guy. I'm a live life in person guy. The best way to live life really is in person. It's hard to live in this world nowadays for someone over 50, shall we say. And it's very, very frustrating because it seems like people, women, whatever, think it's safer or somehow more efficient to meet people in person, but just so much wasted time because you really don't know someone until you're in, you know, in front of them in person. The best place to meet someone is anywhere, outdoors, outside of the home, anywhere, unless someone you're lucky enough to have someone come knocking at your door and ring your doorbell. Outside, get outside, get off the gadget. Please.
I mean, it certainly works for some. I will say that for people who might be shy and introverted, apps have allowed them to seek out partners in a great way. So if you're someone who likes to approach somebody in person, you'll probably meet someone great who likes to be approached. But again, I think, you know, there's no one right way, as we have learned through this podcast.
Rama, thanks for the call. And to Meredith's point, there are lots of people who find great efficiency in the online dating world. And for more on that point, I want to bring in another voice. Joseph Riegel is an associate professor of communication studies at my alma mater, Northeastern University. And he recently wrote about how, in a quest for the perfect person, some people are taking a computer hacking approach to dating. He wrote this for The Conversation. And he joins us now via Skype. Hello, Professor. Happy Valentine's Day.
Hi, Callum. Thank you very much.
So how are people doing it? I mean, explain this phenomenon of sort of hacking the dating world. How exactly are people trying to optimize their search for love?
Well, there's a couple of ways you can go about it, but it really is about bringing that systematic sort of approach of seeing things as a system with moving parts, things that can be optimized, things that can be crawled, and you can pull in lots of data, and then you can target people in very specific ways. So, for example, Amy Webb, who calls herself a data futurist, she wrote a book, and she also had a very popular TED Talk, where she spoke of how she was starting to feel antsy because a relationship had just ended and she wanted to start a family, and she was going about it all the wrong way. And some of the things that she did learn was by creating a lot of fake accounts of the guy, of the sort of guys that she would want to marry. And then she would have those fake male accounts interact with women, and then she could see who the most successful women were, and then she could copy their style.
These are like the trolls that we've been reading about in election hacking.
This is not an honest date. And what do you win at that point, right? To emulate,
Yeah, well, what she won was what works well. So, for instance, one of the insights she learned is that she had copied and pasted stuff from her resume into her dating profile. And she realized that didn't work. And what she did realize is people tended to do well when they were optimistic. They showed a little bit of a shoulder. And they kept it very short, because apparently smart people like to write very long profiles and messages, but those things don't tend to work so well.
And Joe, this is kind of corny, but I was just at a wedding over the weekend, and a theme that keeps coming up, you hear a lot at these weddings when people do find each other, is what they love is the imperfections about each other. I mean, is there something fundamentally flawed about this idea of finding the perfect person through some kind of digital optimization?
I think there is. So Eve mentioned the paradox of choice, and that's the idea that when you have lots of choices available to you, it actually can make you more anxious and more upset, because you think, maybe I just missed the perfect one. So I think we've always had the tendency to think, oh, who is the perfect one? But when you take this data analytic approach to dating, you're thinking, maybe the perfect one is just one more data point away. And you might never be willing to settle, or even if you do settle, and I don't mean to say that in a derogatory term, settling, but maybe you're always thinking, maybe someone else better is right around the corner. And my concern is that when we think of each other as data points and the task is to find the perfect one, it really ignores an important part of relationships, which is it's a negotiation. We grow together.
Always one data point away. What a synopsis of our age. Joseph Riegel, Associate Professor of Communication Studies at Northeastern. Thank you so much for joining us via Skype.
My pleasure.
You can find a link to his piece in The Conversation at radioboston.org. Meredith, let's go to one more caller. Mm-hmm. We have a story about a long-distance relationship, which I think is increasingly a scenario that we encounter in this very mobile age. Haley is calling in from Somerville. Haley, what's your story?
Hi. So I'm Haley, and I'm actually a university student, and I met my significant other while studying abroad, actually. So we met in Hong Kong, and I just wanted to share that we've been together for over a year, and that long distance can really be worth it. And it's been really fun having a cross-cultural relationship. He's originally from Malaysia, and I'm from the U.S. So, for anyone, for what it's worth, just having an open mind, and it's always worth it when you find the right person.
Sounds expensive. Yep. That's the one thing I hear about long distance.
We only see each other like once a year so far.
And perhaps that is also a recipe for relationship success, just a once a year visit.
Haley, how do you make it work?
Yes, we talk every day.
I assume you have to rely heavily on technology to stay in touch.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Because the time zone difference is actually really convenient. It's about 13 hours. So he tucks me in every night, and then I call him, to like say good morning to him. It's pretty convenient. But he just got his visa to the U.S. so he can come to my graduation in the spring. So really looking forward to that.
I love that.
Well, congratulations on relationship success so far, Haley, and good luck. Meredith, what a great synopsis there of a way that you have sort of something. It begins with an in-real-life relationship and then relies on technology
and then becomes,
to keep it going.
Right. And then a reverse app for that.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Meredith Goldstein, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
She is the Love Letters columnist for the Boston Globe.
My favorite day of the year.
Host of the podcast by the same name. Our show is produced by Jamie Bologna. Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, Zoe Mitchell, and Eve Zukoff, who you heard from today. Tim Skog is our technical director, and our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Callum Borchers. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.